You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show.
Someone said to me that you described the firing of James Comey as the biggest mistake in political history.
That'd probably be too bombastic even for me, but maybe modern political history.
Donald Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, bears all in his first ever television interview. So what did we learn from his primetime grilling? I'll ask today's guests, Rosemary Hollis and Brian Klass, what they thought. Plus, a UN vote on the economic fate of nuclear North Korea, a contentious Brexit bill, why one Nobel Prize winner is accused of ethnic cleansing, and the independence dreams of Catalonia. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, who's Professor of International Politics at City University of London, and Brian Klass, who's Fellow in Comparative Politics at the London School of Economics. Welcome both to the programme. Lots to get through today. We're going to begin with North Korea. Today, the United Nations is set to vote on sanctions against the rogue regime following the testing of an ICBM and an escalating nuclear crisis with the US. Pyongyang has threatened pain and suffering ahead of the vote, while Senator John McCain has said the North must know the price for continued aggression is extinction. Brian, what is the outcome potentially of this vote? We know there's been some bartering in the background. It seems that the US has stepped away from the idea of a full oil embargo. Do you think they'll manage to carry the Chinese and Russians with them on this vote?
Well, the problem is that if they are able to basically get the Chinese and the Russians on board, that the sanctions will probably be ineffective because the Chinese and Russians are not keen on instituting regime change effectively, and they're not keen on putting enough pressure on Pyongyang to actually make a difference. And we've had a series of sanctions. So the idea that these ones would be magical and all of a sudden would tip the scales when Kim Jong-un is absolutely determined to maintain nuclear capability in a reasonably rational way to have leverage against the West, it seems that this is unlikely to fundamentally change the calculation or the dynamics of what is rapidly becoming an out-of-control and even more dangerous situation.
But you say that the watered-down sanctions won't work, but would the unwatered-down ones have worked? Because we've seen level after level of sanctions being applied to North Korea, but none of them have really forced the regime's hand in the direction that we'd like to see them go.
This is one of the problems with sanctions, right, is that the people who are in charge, the small group of elites, do not suffer. And the people of North Korea already are suffering some catastrophic quality of life and terrible, terrible living conditions. So I'm skeptical that sanctions will fundamentally change the calculation. I still think that diplomacy is the way forward because it's the only option at this point. To have a war in the Korean Peninsula would likely lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. And Kim Jong-un is not simply going to turn away from the nuclear program willingly, even if there are severe oil and gas sanctions put in place.
Rosemary, we know that John McCain is seen as a less authoritarian voice than, for example, Donald Trump, but even he is talking about it means extinction for you if you don't step away from your nuclear buildup. What do you think he means by that? What do you think the American government thinks it can do if these sanctions don't work?
Well, I was assuming that John McCain was referring to the fact that if you tempt us too far, if you provoke us too far, the consequences will be your obliteration, and presumably you know that, and therefore you wouldn't be going down that route. The problem that the American administration has is telling Kim Jong-un the consequences of building the capability but not using it. And I agree with Brian that the only way forward is diplomacy, but in terms of the American posturing that there's been, especially since the start of the Trump administration, it looks like weakness, and they have a problem with saving face if they are provoked further. I also think that there's experts in the US as well as in Russia and China who have a completely different take on what needs to happen here. And there's an array of choices, and I don't hear everybody piling up behind one of the choices with any confidence that it will, quote-unquote, work in terms of getting the North Koreans to change direction.
And that's the problem here, Brian. There is no... We can say we should try diplomacy. It has been tried many times before. We know that a war on the peninsula, let alone a nuclear war, would be awful, disastrous, you know, have global repercussions. But we're dealing with a man in North Korea who is very difficult to suss out, to understand his ambitions here, and who seems really dead set on pushing ahead further and further with the nuclear program, and very unlikely to be persuaded away from it, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think this is where there is a bit of a misconception in portrayals of Kim Jong-un as being fully irrational, right? Because I think he's an absolute cruel monster who has ruled brutally over his people, but he has understood a fundamental truth, which is that without nuclear weapons, he probably would be gone by now. And I think that that's something that he is very afraid of. And that is why he is the one bargaining chip he's basically unwilling to give up is the one that the U.S. and its Western allies want, which is the nuclear program. So, you know, there really are only a few options. There is the possibility of coercive diplomacy, which they're trying to ramp up, which I think is the way forward. Whether that will work is an open question. There's regime change, which obviously is a huge, you know, question mark about what kind of consequences it could create. Then there's a military solution, which is not actually a solution because it would lead to so many deaths. And finally, there's the option of grave miscalculation on both sides, which is becoming increasingly likely as the erratic statements from the White House match the erratic statements out of Pyongyang, and they're both trying to figure out the other side. And so, you know, I think that we are in a really dangerous situation, and people are sleepwalking around it. That we, a lot of people sort of, you know, think that, okay, the nuclear test has now passed and we have Hurricane Irma in the news. Well, this is an ongoing problem, and there is a risk that this could, you know, break open into a massive, massive diplomatic disaster any day. And so I think it's of the highest priority for Western diplomats to really try to push China further because it's still the only option.
Well, of course, China doesn't want to see the use of force in this situation. So I don't know that they need to be pushed. I think it's a real problem in terms of international diplomacy, international politics, where the agency lies. It's a classic contemporary problem where no collection of actors are either on the same page as to what to do or have the capacity collectively to solve the problem.
But it does feel, Rosemary, just before we move on from this topic, that both Russia and China have a kind of a similar take on what needs to be done, and that certainly is not to...
Except that Putin said we need diplomacy, but didn't offer what kind of diplomacy, to what end. And Brian said diplomacy is the only way forward, but diplomacy to what? To guarantee that there will not be an attempt at regime change or the use of military force? Well, unfortunately, the North Koreans were paying attention to what happened to Gaddafi's regime when it bought the bargain, give up your nuclear weapons, and we won't go for regime change. And then, of course, a new government in the US, in the UK, in France, let's have something other than Gaddafi.
And you think their reading of that Libyan situation is that tight, that they would have taken that as a clear reading of what would happen to them?
It's been mentioned a number of times by commentators who specialise on North Korea, and it struck me that they do have a point if he is paying attention.
Well, we're going to move to the UK now, where the Prime Minister, Theresa May, says she's confident of winning a vote on a Brexit bill today that's being held in the Commons. The bill would overturn a 1972 act that brought Britain into the European Economic Community. The British government has told lawmakers that voting against the bill would result in the UK suffering a chaotic exit from the bill, from the EU, I apologise. Brian, clear that it seems that she will get her way. She has a slim majority with the backing of her friends in Northern Ireland, and it seems very few Tory MPs are going to step out of line, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that this will probably pass, but the warning that there will be a chaotic exit from the EU, welcome to a year ago. We knew this. This is already happening. It is completely chaotic. It is going to be chaotic. And so, you know, I think that the idea that really needs needs to be hammered home in this story is that this bill, having to have extraordinary powers to get it done, doing it in the dead of night, trying to have this threat of chaos if you don't get it, doesn't exactly send the signal of strong and stable leadership that Theresa May ran on to Brussels, right? They're looking at this and saying, you know, already there are cracks in the system. They have a narrow majority. They're having to whip votes on even initiating this process. What is it going to be like when there are actually consequential decisions about what the actual final bill looks like? And that's where I think Brussels is right to see that Britain is in a very weak negotiating position here.
And I worry that what the British government is doing at the moment is trying to find a place to blame a group of actors to blame for what they know is going to be chaotic. And there's been several attempts to make sure that it's Brussels and the Brussels bureaucrats and the Michel Barnier in particular who's going to take the blame, when the well-meaning British who want a reasonable deal and a smooth transition don't get it. But this is blaming the Labour Party and any opponents of this power grab, which is built into the powers of the bill that is being debated. Anybody who opposes that, for reasons not to do with Brexit, but to do with how they, as parliamentarians, feel that they should defend the sovereignty of Parliament against the executive. And now there, I think it's a simple technique by the government to say they're going to be the problem for Brexit, when in actual fact they're trying to be the answer to the sovereignty debate.
But do you think, Rosemary, that what's interesting about the Labour move, and we've seen today some suggestions from Jeremy Corbyn that he might even contemplate staying in the single market under the right circumstances, is that both their supporters and other MPs and the whole establishment, they find it quite hard to hold on to what Jeremy Corbyn thinks about this process. He was lukewarm in his campaigning for remaining in the EU, and then seemed very determined that it was a good thing that we were going. And now there seems to be, whether from him or the people around him, some kind of row back, and where does he sit on this? So do you think he loses some credibility in these debates because we just don't know what he's trying to get out of it, other than kind of ruffle the feathers of the Tories?
Well, I think that was definitely the problem earlier this last summer, that we didn't know exactly what the Labour Party stood for. And there were a lot of Remainers who were very upset that they'd got to go along with exiting the European Union. But they kind of closed ranks and organised themselves towards the end of the summer. And Jeremy Corbyn's indications were that he was for staying in the single market and the customs union for the transition period, and that could be quite a long transition period. And so I think the Labour Party is in a better position than it was in terms of what it stands for. And really, if they were obliged to negotiate a deal themselves rather than leave it to the Tory leadership, they would have a terrible time getting a better deal without a transition period, in terms of the priorities of the Labour Party, which are perfectly clear. And those are the ones that the British people wanted protected in exiting the EU, which is jobs and the rights of workers compared to the big corporations. You can make the case that the European Union is most popular amongst the multinationals and not amongst some small British businesses. It's not all a simple business case.
But Brian, there's going to be a brutal awakening once we're not part of the EU and people see that their jobs don't change and their circumstances don't change, because actually the country is poorer and less able to manoeuvre, surely.
Yeah, I mean, this is where there's going to be a reasonably rapid awakening of understanding that misinformation was sold to voters last year. And you make vague campaign promises in democracy. This is a hallmark of democratic campaigning. But in this situation, you had very specific promises about what would happen when the EU, if Brexit passed, and those things are not going to happen, right? I mean, people are going to understand that £350 million a week is not going back to the NHS. And so very quickly, as the actual votes come up, as the negotiation contours come up, as the payment for the exit bill is paid, people are going to be held to account for this. And I think that this is something that is rarer in democratic politics, where you have very specific promises crumble into ashes before voters' eyes after just a very short period of time.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. Up next, still with me, will be Brian Klass and Rosemary Hollis, of course. But we're going to look at what happens when a former Nobel Peace Prize winner is accused of ethnic cleansing. And we'll find out why Donald Trump's biggest mistake has been, well, according to one of his former strategists, well, something to do with Mr. James Comey.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
Well, welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Brian Klass from the London School of Economics and Rosemary Hollis from the City University here in London. Now, to a story we've been following extensively here at Monocle 24, the unravelling situation on the border between Myanmar and Bangladesh. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have crossed over from Myanmar into Bangladesh, fleeing a military crackdown. Observers say that this crackdown is an attempt at ethnic cleansing, while the government says it's killing terrorists. Well, Rosemary, this weekend, the New York Times ran a piece entitled A Nobel Prize Winner's Shame, sharply criticising the leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, for not doing enough about the situation. What's your read on her actions?
Well, I tend to the view that she is an ambitious politician. She has made a calculation as to whether it would do her any good politically to take a stand on this in the name of human rights. She has actually previously said that she never intended to be a human rights champion worldwide. Her ambitions are very specifically in Myanmar. And she is now so close to realizing her leadership bid more profoundly with party support and on the right side from her point of view of the military, that she's not going to let this issue get in her way. And I think this is very sad for the Rohingya Muslims, who are having a dreadful time, but also I think it's sad for all those who put their hopes in Aung San Suu Kyi as a champion of human rights, per se.
Is there something wrong with us, Brian, in the way that we kind of got a bit carried away with, you know, her story? You know, she was, you know, this kind of charismatic woman. She kind of dressed the part. She looked the part. She was this frail woman supposedly standing up to these, the brutes of the military. Did we get a bit too carried away by the narrative and miss the fact that, as Rosemary says, she's just a politician at the end of the day?
Well, I think that we've made the mistake of defining her by what she's opposing, right? And I think that this happens very often in politics, is the person who is against something bad is automatically good. And that's not always the case. And this is a very clear illustration that she is not courageous, that she is being cowardly in this instance. And I also think that it's something where, you know, historically, all of the positive goodwill that she has developed over time has been erased in these last few weeks. Beyond that, I'm really struck because, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Bangkok doing research on Thai politics, and the narrative for the last several years, especially since 2014 when Thailand suffered a military coup, was Thailand is going in exactly the wrong direction, Myanmar is going in exactly the right direction. They were just, you know, complete opposites. And I think we read into these narratives of democratic transition as something that is a determined force once it begins, and it certainly is not. And I think that, you know, she is not a champion of democracy, human rights, or any of the things that we attributed to her.
Wait a minute. Don't you think you're making it a little bit black and white.
No, I don't. I mean, I think that she has been given an opportunity to stand at a moment in history when thousands of people are being murdered, raped, and having their villages burned down. And she is not only being silent, she is actually gaslighting and saying that these things are not happening by the Myanmar military.
Very painful to watch, but let's compare it, for example, when we see the Assad regime committing horrendous crimes against the Syrian population, and we get into the debate as outsiders who want to do something to stop this. What exactly do you have to do to stop it? Now, in her case, if she can get power, one could concede that once she's in power, she's going to be better than what we've got now.
But that's hard to judge, isn't it, Rosemary?
It's impossible to judge. But to say that she's not a campaigner for democracy is...
Well, this was her chance to prove it. This is her chance to prove it. I mean, it's easy to be a champion for democracy in house arrest. It's not easy to be a champion for democracy when you're near power. And I think that that's where you're really defined. And honestly, I mean, I think there's a lot of people throughout history who have committed mass atrocities who figured, I'll be better once I'm in power, and they weren't. And I think that the more that we become apologists for these people and use terms like ethnic cleansing to refer to actual mass murder of people and say, oh, she's just trapped in an impossible situation, the more we end up with mass atrocities.
Do you think, Rosemary, she doesn't have the full leadership of the country because, you know, she married somebody who is British, you know, she has children who were born outside of Myanmar, so there's been these hurdles to her taking full power, but she is the de facto leader, isn't she, already, of Burma?
Yes, but all the commentary that I hear says that even if she wanted to, and I concede, it doesn't look like she does, but even if she wanted to, she couldn't stop the ethnic cleansing, the seemingly, according to the latest UN statements, genocide that is taking place. And she, as a nationalist, sounds to me like she doesn't see the enormity of the problem in human rights terms. I'm not sure that being a champion of democracy is quite the point. She's found her way into winning an election for her party in technically non-military democratic terms. She has not used violence in pursuit of her campaign inside Myanmar. I think the issue is human rights issues. And on that score, I think there's politicians all around the world who frame some of their human rights issues cover up.
But maybe it was a mistake to give her the Nobel Peace Prize so early on in her career before she was tested for her genuine leadership.
And it would appear that she was given it for reasons that are not panning out.
Exactly. Well, we're going to move on now because this weekend, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's former chief strategist, who left his position on the 18th of August, gave his first ever TV interview with Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes. Well, let's hear what he had to say about charges that Trump and his team colluded with Russia.
There's nothing to the Russia investigation. It's a waste of time.
What do you believe? You know what the national security institutions believe. What do you believe?
We mean what they believe. We don't really, I mean, that there may have been. I think, look, I was there. It's a total and complete farce. Russian collusion is a farce.
Okay, I didn't say collusion. Did the Russians try to influence the election?
If you consider maybe something they did at the DNC.
Maybe something they did?
Maybe something that.
That's not what the CIA believes. That's not what the FBI believes.
Have you seen the intelligence reports?
No.
Okay, fine. So you don't
know. Have you seen the intelligence reports?
I have seen the intelligence reports.
Are you saying to me those intelligence reports do not suggest that the Russians tried to influence the election?
I would never devolve classified information on this show. But let me tell you, I think it's far from conclusive that the Russians had any impact on this election.
Well, that's not the question. Did they try to influence the American election? That's what the investigation is about.
We'll have to wait till the investigation is finished.
Brian, what did you make of his performance?
Well, I mean, it's a complete dodge. And I think it's providing serious political cover to Russia a little more than a year before the next elections, a little less than a year after the last ones, in which they very clearly interfered. And there's a mountain of evidence out there to show that this happened using cyber tools, hacking,
buying ads on Facebook, also Russians directly reaching out to the Trump campaign. So, you know, this is a narrative that is, for whatever reason, the Bannonite wing of the White House, which now, you know, is not in the White House, is clinging to a narrative that is just simply being disproved day by day. And I think that Steve Bannon is going to try to attack the Republican establishment and continue with this narrative about Russia from outside the West Wing. He may end up doing more harm to the Republicans than he does to the Democrats.
Rosemary, when you heard the interview, did you hear a man who was, you know, speaking the truth, or did you find him as equally slippery as Brian?
As Brian did, you mean?
Yes, yes. Not as Brian. Certainly not as Brian. Brian is far from slippery. Brian is determined and on the spot, I might point out, Rosemary, despite your recent interactions. Tell me, what did you make
just wanted to be clear on that.
You can weigh in there as well.
The slipperiness of Steve Bannon in this interview is... in terms of his real concern, is that the enemies of the Trump White House and the version of Trump that Steve Bannon prefers, like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan, they are the people that he's afraid are trying to deprive or reverse the election result, the Trump election result. And so it's he's dealing with this inquiry vis-a-vis the Russians as a matter of political competition between different sectors of the Republican Party and different representations of Trump.
Well, we're going to move on to one final subject today. Will Catalonia secede from Spain? And if so, when? Today on Diada Day, which commemorates the fall of Barcelona to Spain in the early 18th century, hundreds of thousands of Catalans are holding a rally in Barcelona to show support for independence. Last Thursday, Spain's Constitutional Court suspended a referendum planned for the 1st of October following a challenge by Spain's Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy. The government claims the referendum would be unconstitutional. Well, Aliam Aldous will be reporting from Barcelona on tonight's Monocle Daily, so do tune in then. But Rosemary, do you think they will become an independent nation?
If you want my prediction, and it's not a very well-informed one on this particular subject, I have to say, but looking at secessionist movements and the whole debate around how the EU feels about that, and the examples of Scottish devolution, Welsh devolution, and now the mess that we've got with how you deal with a new international border, all of those things suggest to me that it won't be a straightforward yes.
And for you, Brian, the notion of them going for independence, as Rosemary said, the EU might say, well, you can certainly leave the EU then, because we don't want to encourage that in other states. And Spain would have a very powerful voice in that debate. Do you think that that is something that might temper the demands for independence in the end?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's striking about these local movements for independence away from a national organization, or a country, is that there's pro-European attitudes are increasing in tandem with pro-local attitudes, right? And you see this in Scotland, you see this in Catalonia, and, you know, Spain would veto European Union membership for Catalonia. So basically, you know, if they actually went through the decision, it would be a very consequential one for their economy and also for their local identity within the European context.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to our guests here in the studio, Rosemary Hollis and Brian Klass. And today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Maddie Speed. And our studio manager was David Stevens. Coming up later on, there's going to be the Monocle Daily, when Liam Aldous will be reporting from Barcelona. So make sure you listen out for that. But straight after here, there's a little bit of music. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with one and only Mr. Robert Bound. And Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But in the meantime, make sure that you head down to the news kiosk and pick up the latest issue of Monocle magazine. And if you're snappy, you might even find the latest editions of the Monocle newspaper, which was our summer experiment in August. And don't forget, on Thursday, there's The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So stay tuned for a great week here on Monocle 24. But from now, from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.